From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On the program today, 30 nations meet in Paris and agree to do everything they can to halt Islamic State. We'll ask, what does that mean? Also, the US unveils fresh humanitarian aid for Syria, a country where half the people are now on the move.
I think it shows the world, including some of the victims of the Assad regime, that we have not lost interest. We are committed to helping them.
Should the West pay Islamic State ransom for the hostages it holds? A British lawmaker tells us why not. And
we have a report from California, where robots may be about to revolutionize room service.
That's all ahead on today's edition of FSN Reports, after our summary of the main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. International diplomats in Paris have pledged their full support to eradicate the threat of Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. A joint statement by a group of 30 countries says that could include military assistance. Foreign leaders promised to fight ISIS using all means necessary. Meanwhile, the Obama administration is putting pressure on Congress to approve funding to train and arm Syrian rebels. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the U.S. wants to get the rebels ready to take on ISIS.
The goal here is to ensure that we have, or that there is, a fighting force on the ground in Syria that can take the fight to ISIL in Syria. The president has ruled out the use of American combat troops for that purpose.
Around 500 migrants are believed to have drowned after a boating accident near Malta last week. The news is emerging now as two Palestinian survivors spoke about what they're describing as an intentional crash by other traffickers patrolling the seas. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
Speaking to the International Organization for Migration, two survivors say their boat, which departed Egypt last week, was sunk by a vessel belonging to other traffickers. The Palestinians say a confrontation occurred when their fellow passengers refused to board a less safe boat. They were two of nine survivors aboard the vessel carrying 500 Sudanese, Egyptian, Syrian, and Palestinian migrants seeking asylum in Europe. The news comes as another boat carrying 250 people sank off the Libyan coast on Monday and adds to a total of more than 2,500 migrants who've lost their lives at sea so far this year.
The UK Prime Minister David Cameron is in Scotland as the final 72 hours of campaigning get underway ahead of the independence referendum on Thursday. Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond has again criticized the scaremongering of the No campaign, while David Cameron delivers what he calls head and heart reasons to reject independence. Our correspondent Dan Whitehead is in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh.
No one expected the race to be this close, and both the Yes campaign and Better Together are throwing everything at these final 3 days of campaigning. Alex Salmond met with business leaders at Edinburgh Airport, describing the independence referendum as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Scotland to create an economic and jobs policy for Scotland's needs. But David Cameron is also in Scotland to put forward his arguments against independence, saying there would be no way back if Scots vote to leave. Both sides will be working 24/7 to secure votes from the many still undecided.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Microsoft has bought Mojang, maker of the hit video game Minecraft, for $2.5 billion. The move is being seen as an attempt to boost the company's Xbox game console and, more crucially, its mobile platform. Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco.
Swedish developer Mojang's open-world game Minecraft has been downloaded almost 100 million times since it launched in 2009 and is the top-paid app for both iOS and Android. Players roam around a virtual Lego set, building new objects in a simple landscape of woods and beaches. The game's creator said last year that Windows phones weren't worth developing for because they hold such a tiny market share, an estimated 2.5%. Microsoft is hoping the acquisition can reverse this trend of being ignored by developers by using Minecraft as a driver to sell its phones to existing Minecraft fans, part of CEO Satya Nadella's mobile and cloud strategy. But some analysts are skeptical, saying Minecraft is better played on tablets because of their bigger screens.
And U.S. President Barack Obama is planning to announce a major ramp-up of efforts to combat the Ebola virus in West Africa. It will include providing mobile hospitals, personnel, and medical supplies and training, according to the Wall Street Journal. From Washington, here's Daniel Wrenches.
The White House has now acknowledged that the U.S. response has been insufficient to meet the challenges of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Last week, President Obama received a letter from the President of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, saying, "At this rate, we will never break the transmission chain and the virus will overwhelm us." The U.S. is planning to mobilize the U.S. military, and Congress is expected to approve a request for an additional $88 million to bring the total U.S. contribution to $250 million. The Wall Street Journal says President Obama will announce more details, including sending portable hospitals, doctors, healthcare experts, medical supplies, and trainers to Liberia and other countries in the region.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, welcome to FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks.
It falls to the government and to each and every one of us to drain this poison from our society and to take on this warped ideology that is radicalizing some of our young people. The murder of David Haines at the hands of ISIL will not lead Britain to shirk our responsibility with our allies to deal with the threat that this organization poses.
David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, vowing the Islamic State militants who murdered relief worker David Haines will be brought to justice. The videotape showing Mr. Haines' beheading was released by Islamic State on Saturday and sent the kind of shockwaves through Britain that the US experienced after the murder of journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. The US government says momentum is building for a broad coalition to conduct airstrikes against Islamic State positions in Iraq and Syria. And in Paris today, the governments of more than 30 nations agreed to take whatever means necessary to overcome the threat posed by Islamic State. FSN's London bureau chief, Ollie Barrett, joins me now. And Ollie, Secretary of State John Kerry claimed this weekend that support for US airstrikes is building, with some as yet unnamed Arab nations agreeing to participate. Was that evident in Paris, and what did the conference achieve today?
Well, there was some evidence of this idea of a coalition of the willing beginning to emerge. There were over 30 countries in attendance. There were Arab states there too. But in terms of what the conference itself actually achieved, I think it's fair to say very little, really. The countries there did agree that they would tackle the Islamic State or ISIL, whatever means were necessary, but no real discussion as to what those means are or when they might be put into effect. I mean, we've heard today from France that it's going to start flying surveillance missions in the region, like the UK has already been doing, and there's growing speculation that France will take part in airstrikes. But what we didn't get out of Paris today was any clear timetable or any clear commitment from these countries that the US says it are entering into this coalition as to what exactly they are prepared to commit, especially in terms of military resources. We didn't hear any further detail about airstrikes or troops on the ground or anything like that.
The US expressed solidarity with Britain over the weekend in the aftermath of David Haines' execution. Is there any indication that the weekend's events have hardened public attitudes in Britain? And does that give David Cameron more latitude to become an active participant in the president's coalition?
I think it is fair to say that public attitudes in the UK are hardening. It's actually been the case that if you look at the polls in recent weeks after the beheadings of the two American journalists, that polls were beginning to move in that direction, that public opinion was beginning to turn towards supporting the idea of taking much stronger action against the Islamic State. And actually, what's interesting is that this time around, Parliament seems to be ahead of the Prime Minister. But it was a year or so ago now that David Cameron wanted to take military action in Syria, took the idea to Parliament, it was rejected, and he's been scarred by that process, but also says he learnt his lesson. This time around, David Cameron is being the cautious one. Parliament, it seems, would be much more keen on the idea of getting tougher with Islamic State and perhaps in involvement in airstrikes. David Cameron, I think, ideally would like to be part of this coalition that is taking military action, with the UK actually not actively involved in that military action, with the UK providing logistic support, surveillance support, continuing to give humanitarian aid. But the pressure is growing for the UK to be involved in airstrikes, not just here domestically, but internationally too, partly because of the involvement of these Britons, it seems, in these executions and the amount of Britons that have travelled, we know, to Syria and Iraq to fight.
And of course, the Islamic State militants appear to be holding another British humanitarian aid worker identified as Alan Henning. He was seen at the end of the tape showing Mr. Haynes' murder. Do we know if the British government is making any headway identifying the British-accented militant who seems to have killed Mr. Haynes and before him James Foley and Stephen Sotloff?
Well, there are reports in the British media that British security services think they have identified the man who seems to be the murderer of those three men who has that British accent. A few figures have been named in the British press as possible suspects, but many of those have, we understand, now actually been ruled out. But in a sense, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference whether British security services know who this man is exactly or not, because that may not give them any extra information about where he is, who is with him, how many hostages he is holding, or anything like that, especially if he's been out of contact completely with friends and family in Britain in recent months. So it does look like British security services have some idea who this British-accented murderer is, but that doesn't necessarily help British security services find him or bring him to justice or make a genuine impact on tackling these Islamic State militants and particularly those that are holding these hostages.
FSN's Ollie Barrett on the line from London. As we said, the murder of David Haynes has sent shockwaves through British society. Bob Stewart is a Member of Parliament with Britain's Conservative Party, which leads the country's governing coalition. He's also a retired colonel with the British Army.
David Cameron's already made a very strong and good statement, good insofar as much as we can do, about what we should do. In Paris, all the nations gathered there would decide how they're going to face up to this threat from ISIS. And quite frankly, the real question is how much military forces, how much military are you going to contribute on the ground in the end? Because it doesn't look, and it's quite sensible, that the United States and the United Kingdom at this point don't put soldiers on the ground, because quite frankly, that's exactly what ISIS wants us to do. Because then they can claim it's a war of Muslims against the West, which is palpable rubbish.
Meanwhile, though, Bob, we've seen Australia yesterday offering those extra jets, more boots on the ground, at least from them. Should we take a more active military role? Are we actually in a position to do it? Do we have the resources? Do we have the budget?
That's four questions. Should we take a more active military role? We probably will have to. Should we put soldiers on the ground? Not at this point. Do we have the budget? We'd have to make the budget. And do we have the soldiers? Not really. We're a bit pressed on soldiers at the moment.
Is it time to start talking about ransoms, Bob?
No. You can't. We shouldn't. We mustn't. It's tragic. It's a real dilemma, this. Of course it is. But frankly, those nations that have paid ransoms have made it much more difficult for those people trying to stop future hostage-taking. Certainly for their own countries. And the fact of the matter is, the conventional wisdom, the truth is, if you start paying ransoms, you'll get more hostages, and in the end, you'll have more people dying.
Bob Stewart, a Conservative Party lawmaker in London, talking there to Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC Radio. The Obama administration, meantime, has announced an additional $500 million to fund humanitarian relief efforts for the millions impacted by the three-year-long civil war in Syria and the spreading violence in Iraq. The United Nations says 6.5 million people have been displaced by the conflict in Syria alone, with almost half the country's population now forced to leave their homes. FSN's Priscilla Huff spoke to Assistant Secretary of State Ann Richard about the new US efforts to help.
At this point of the year, A lot of the UN agencies are running short on funding because their fiscal year follows the calendar year. So in September, October, November, some of the funding they've gotten from other governments starts to dry up. So we're very pleased that the Secretary was able to announce today in Turkey $500 million of additional U.S. aid to address the Syria crisis.
Now, what kind of signal does this send to other folks, to other regional partners? The U.S. is making another enormous financial contribution, and they've said they're going to step up. But what sort of signal does this send that the U.S. is stepping up in a big way?
I think it shows the world, including some of the victims of the Assad regime, that we have not lost interest. We are committed to helping them. And it's a symbol of American generosity in this type of crisis all around the world.
Now, this humanitarian crisis, it covers a vast region from Syria to Turkey, down through Jordan, across to Iraq. Who needs the most help at this point?
Both for people inside Syria who've been displaced, getting aid from the United Nations, getting aid in through other channels, through non-governmental organizations, and it's also for refugees who fled to neighboring countries. And what people may find interesting is a piece of it is also for those communities who are hosting refugees so that their needs also not be neglected, that they don't somehow be disadvantaged by doing the right thing and allowing refugees to come live alongside them.
Now, one thing that's changed in the past several weeks, couple of months, is the rapid expansion of the Islamic State. Has the expansion of the Islamic State, from your perspective, changed the humanitarian situation on the ground, and what can you help do about that?
The expansion of ISIL has meant that needs have increased. We're not just talking about problems inside Syria, we're also helping displaced people in Iraq right now who are fleeing really terrible violence and also need help. The other thing is it means we have to do more. We have to get more aid workers in. We have to stretch our resources to do more than we did before. And we've had all along a problem of reaching the people who need help inside Syria, crossing battle lines, getting inside besieged cities. So the expansion of ISIL has further complicated an already very challenging situation.
Have discussions begun on long-term solutions about resettlement, or how do we address what could be years of humanitarian crisis going forward?
I think we all acknowledge that this will not be over soon, because even if in the best possible scenarios peace were to return to this region, it would be some time before people could really go home again. Inside Syria, homes have been destroyed, hospitals are gone, schools are being occupied by displaced people. It's going to take a long time to put together what used to be a functioning country. And so we will definitely, looking ahead, need to do a major reconstruction effort in that part of the world, which is one of the great tragedies of such a widespread and really horrible war.
Assistant Secretary of State Anne Richard, she was talking there to FSN's Priscilla Huff.
This is FSN Reports. Next tonight, a complete change of pace. Robots are increasingly taking some of the burden of mundane tasks away from human beings. Robotic assembly lines have reinvented manufacturing, and now small machines, seemingly with a mind of their own, are starting to be used in the service industry. From San Francisco, Rebecca Boring reports.
One high-tech hotel in Cupertino, California, hopes to be spearheading a room service revolution. It's trialing the first on-call robotic butler.
It is my great privilege and pleasure to introduce to you the butler, named
Amo. Butler wears a bow tie, has a touchscreen face, and resembles a mid-20th century vision of the future. That's according to Brian McGinnis, global brand manager at Starwood Group.
It really is that moment of Rosie the Maid on the Jetsons and R2-D2, and that sense of just something new and different, really just to bring a smile to the guest's face.
The mini concierge is tasked with delivering items like phone chargers, snacks or toothbrushes from the lobby to guests' rooms. It finds its way around with sensors and lasers and uses Wi-Fi to call the elevator or alert someone to its arrival. Rather than tipping, guests can show their appreciation via a tweet. Bottler was built from 3D printed parts by a Silicon Valley company specializing in robotic helpers for the disabled. Dr. Tessa Lau is chief robot whisperer at Savioke.
What Bottler does is he frees up the talent at the hotel to actually really look after the guests the way they want to provide a higher level of service and delight their guests better.
Like Dyson's new robotic vacuum cleaner, Bottler belongs to an expanding class of mobile robots that support humans by taking on labor-intensive tasks. Self-driving cars such as the one Google's developing promise to shake up the automotive industry and take the pain out of our daily commute. While robots are now much more than factory-based heavy lifters or paint sprayers, Christina Bonington, robotics writer at Wired, says navigational limitations mean truly autonomous machines remain a long way off.
They need a really structured environment in order to survive and thrive. They need to be able to sense where they're going, see what obstacles they have, and those obstacles need to not be moving around a lot.
Interacting with Bottler is certainly not yet a glitch-free experience. But as processors, sensors, batteries and software all grow more sophisticated, our robot helpers should too. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And if you've been wondering whatever happened to Peter Aspdon, the arts editor of the Financial Times, whose commentaries we carry regularly on the programme, well, it turns out that he's been on holiday in Greece.
The priest, all the villagers agreed, was nowhere to be found. Effigie, they said. He's gone. I was a little surprised, as it was a Sunday morning. But evidently I had missed the service, and the papas wasn't hanging around. It was a shame, I said to anyone who would listen. The priest was the man with the key, and without the key, no one could get inside the church. And the church just happened to contain some extraordinary treasures. Paintings of apostles from the 6th or 7th centuries, fragments of 9th century and iconic decoration, an 11th century Annunciation executed with a particularly graceful hand. I had studied my blue guide to Naxos while enjoying one of the Greek island's expansive beaches and decided to take a trip inland to the village of Halki to take a rest from the resting. But the priest from the Protothronos church was nowhere to be found. Nor was anyone around to open the doors of Agios Yorgos Diasoritis, 11th century paintings of St. George and his mother St. Polychronia, busts of saints on the eastern piers, despite the blue guide's cheerful advice that it was generally open between 10 and 2:30 with custodian in summer. I sat with a friendly lady outside one of the village shops, and she offered me a plate of fresh figs. Was there a custodian to whom I could complain about the absence of custodians? Her eyebrows flew off the top of her head, the edges of her mouth curled downward. There was a crisis, she said. I had heard, I said. There was no one to pay for the opening of the churches. The only one that I was likely to find open was just down the road, she went on, the church of Panagia Drosiani. It was a good tip. The complex of chapels, which dates back to the late 6th century, is set in the hills among olive groves and contains remarkable frescoes, including an Ascension and an unknown saint bearing, so it says in the book, a medical kit bag. Now here's the thing, I said to the custodian when we had moved the conversation on from the deficiencies of Anglicanism. I know there's a crisis, but as a result, Greece is dependent more than ever on tourism. And like many countries in a similar position, it wants to move away from cheap tourism, as so fetchingly portrayed in the first In-Betweeners movie, and attract a higher class of sunseeker. So you had to give them more than the sun, I said, more than the twinkling seas and the tinkling bouzoukis. You had to give them culture, because in a world in which Abu Dhabi and Hong Kong were selling themselves as global hubs of cultural activity, Greece of all places really ought to make the effort to cut a spare set of keys or two. But as I drove away, I began to wonder what it was that cultural tourism ever really achieved for the visitor rather than the recipient economy. Was it just another form of vacation kitsch, ticking off all the unknown saints, extra points for pre-iconoclastic material, jackpot if you pick a fig off a nearby tree and ponder for a second or two about the unchanging landscape and the continuity of human affairs? Another half hour up the road, past the island's dramatic marble quarries, I went in search of still more rarefied treasure, the unfinished Kouroi of Flerio. Because of the quality and abundance of its marble, Naxos was an important supplier of Kouroi, giant statues of idealized young men or gods, to the rest of Greece. Here were a couple left semi-complete, greying and eroded, that hadn't made the grade. Both are chopped at the knees. Unfortunate accidents, perhaps, dating back more than 2,500 years, causing cancellation of the order. There were, at the site of the second Kouros at least, no other visitors. The fallen idol, some 6 metres in length, made for an emotionally complicated spectacle. It was both dignified and pathetic. It was the ideal brought literally to earth, and staying there, stubborn, abandoned and alone. And yes, I pondered on the unchanging landscape and the continuity of human affairs. Here's a cultural tip for visiting Greece. Forget, for a day or two at least, the guides and the top tens. There are three essential books for understanding the spirit of what you are looking at. Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy, Henry Miller's The Colossus of Marousi, and Kimon Fryer's finely annotated collection of modern Greek poetry. All of them talk about the tension of classical Greece, the ability of this ancient society to balance the two sides of humankind, the noble and the barbaric, cognizant that both qualities resided inside us and that neither could be fully suppressed. Fryer, who was a half-Greek American academic, writes movingly of how classicism's perfection of form was poignant because it expressed an ideal which was known to be unattainable. It symbolised the aspiration of a people who hoped life could always be like this, formally elegant, pacific, beautiful, but who knew it was not. There was always, to quote Nietzsche's formula, a Dionysus to run malicious rings around Apollo. I returned to Britain to find fevered discussion of a warring world that is still caught between the ideals of enlightenment and the facts of brutality. There's nothing like a public beheading to deflate any idea that we are moving on as a species. The prostrate Kouroi would have recognised it, and so would the saints with the medical kit bags. If only we could get to know them better.
Peter Aspden of the Financial Times, now safely back behind his desk in London. You can read his coverage of the arts world regularly in the paper and online at ft.com. And that's FSN Reports for this Monday. Tomorrow, the latest from the FSN reporting team in Edinburgh as Scots prepare for Thursday's vote on independence. That's tomorrow. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. I'm Simon Marks. Goodbye from Washington.